I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, the podcast that asks the question,
what was it like to live at a certain moment, day to day? What was it like?
What was it like?
And what about exactly 25 years ago? What was that like? Well, we got a boatload of great NPR stories from October 84 that should help us answer the question, including an interview with a What Was It Like man himself, Mr. Studs Terkel.
There's stories to be told that are unexpected.
Our favorite kind here at Playback, like this story from filmmaker John Waters, who takes us out for a night at the Demolition Derby.
And I think tonight is called Maniacs Night here tonight, which I can't wait to see exactly what, I'm not sure if they mean the drivers or the fans, but we will soon discover.
Stay tuned for the true meaning of Maniacs Night. And guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan tells us where he finds his musical inspiration.
Well, everything I ever heard that excited me, I've got in my music on purpose.
We'll have a cold shot of Stevie Ray Vaughan, fitting music for these stories from the fall of 1984. It's the final stretch of the 84 presidential election, and guess what? The candidates were acting not very nice. Even the vice presidential candidates were mouthing off from the sidelines. Enter the now famous altercation between Democratic vice presidential hopeful Geraldine Ferraro and Barbara Bush, the wife of Republican VP candidate George Herbert Walker Bush. Here's NPR's Cokie Roberts.
First, it was Barbara Bush talking about Geraldine Ferraro, quote, as a $4 million, I can't say it, but it rhymes with rich, unquote. Mrs. Bush later called Mrs. Ferraro to apologize. But then the vice president's press secretary said on the eve of the debate that Congresswoman Ferraro was bitchy and arrogant. Then, the day after the debate, Vice President Bush told a group of longshoremen in New Jersey he had, quote, tried to kick a little ass last night, unquote. Today, Congresswoman Ferraro said the Bushes are not the type of people who accidentally let something like that slip out. Mrs. Ferraro's accusation was repeated by the Democratic National Committee's political director, Ann Lewis.
Well, one reason I think it is deliberate is that there is just no history in George Bush as a public man of his using vulgar language consistently. He has never been that kind of person. And for suddenly, in the last 3 weeks, the Bush campaign to be the source of vulgarity and off-color language every 3 days suggests to me that it is not accidental. I think it is deliberate. I think it is a very unfortunate response to Geraldine Ferraro as his opponent. But it is going on, and we ought to know it.
Lewis believes the Bush campaign is attempting to throw Ferraro off her stride and arouse prejudice against her. Today, a spokeswoman for the vice president said the remarks were not part of any orchestrated campaign. Quote, I can't imagine anyone orchestrating that kind of campaign, unquote. The spokeswoman pointed out that Mrs. Bush's remark was made in a joking way to a couple of reporters, and the vice president's comment was almost whispered to a longshoreman. Bush held a press conference last Friday after reporters heard a tape of his remark.
Well, it's an athletic expression, and I stand behind it. I use it all the time. My kids use it. Everybody that competes in sports uses it. I just don't like to use it in public. And I was not talking in public, but now I guess I am. You sized it up just exactly right. No more questions on this subject.
Since that time, Vice President Bush himself has made repeated references to his remark. He told a Republican dinner in Los Angeles that he and Mrs. Bush almost didn't make it. Quote, we were up in our room washing our mouths out with soap. Later, the vice president jokingly said he had attended the World Series final game and then tried to visit the team's locker rooms, but the managers wouldn't let him in because, quote, they said my filthy language might corrupt the players. The Democratic National Committee's Ann Lewis calls this series of statements the Jackie Robinson effect. Says Lewis, after Robinson took the field as the first black Major League Baseball player, he was subjected to scrutiny, pressure, and abuse. Now, says Lewis, the same thing's happening to the first woman nominated for vice president.
She has had the scrutiny, and she came through it very well. She has had the pressure. She has come through it very well. And now, and I say this regrettably, I think the other side is resorting to abuse.
I'm Cokie Roberts in Washington.
Politics in India took on a different level of incivility that October. Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, one of the most powerful women in the history of India, was assassinated.
Mrs. Gandhi had come out of her residence and was walking towards her office for a video recording by a British team. Security guards opened fire on Mrs. Gandhi. Mrs. Gandhi's secretary, Mr. R.K. Dhawan, rushed her to the hospital in a car. She was unconscious and bleeding profusely. Reports from the government hospital say that Mrs. Gandhi died about an hour and a half after arriving there and despite an emergency operation to remove 7 bullets.
Here's NPR's Scott Simon with a portrait of the extraordinary and sometimes controversial leader.
To her admirers, and there were hundreds of millions of them, Indira Gandhi was determined and unyielding. But to her detractors, and there were also hundreds of millions of those, she was considered mean and unsparing. Yet they might all agree that she was indisputably indomitable.
Determination is something I seem to have been born with. And I am determined to make something out of this country, to give it a proper direction and so on. And for that, I'm very single-minded, I think.
She was not the daughter of Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi was just the family name of a man she'd married, then left in 1947 to join her father, Jawaharlal Nehru, in the Prime Minister's residence in New Delhi. She didn't occupy political office until her father died in 1964, but by 1966, she'd been selected a compromise candidate for Prime Minister by the Congress Party her family had helped finance and found. It was thought then that Indira Gandhi would serve simply a short transitional term between the older revolutionary leadership of India and a newer, more pragmatic management style of government. But Mrs. Gandhi pruned her rivals from out of the higher branches of the party and instead served 15 years over 2 terms as prime minister. And until the time of her assassination early today, she was often considered the only individual in India capable of capturing a popular majority in a nation of more than 700 million people. Under Indira Gandhi, the nation, which had been founded on nonviolent resistance, became a military power, defeating Pakistan in a war, ultimately exploding a nuclear device in 1974. But it was the people of India themselves who drove her from office in 1977 by defeating her Congress Party for re-election. Mrs. Gandhi served a brief term in prison when the Indian Supreme Court ruled against her emergency measures, but the public pain and humiliation of Jawaharlal Nehru's daughter, the former prime minister, serving time in jail seemed to rejuvenate Mrs. Gandhi's political image by humbling it. In a nation founded by men and women who'd suffered in prison for their convictions, Indira Gandhi, too, had finally paid the price of her beliefs. She was returned to office in 1980 by her largest parliamentary margin ever and became a leader in the non-aligned movement of nations. Yet again, the peculiar, almost intimate disputes of Indian politics intruded on the agenda she was preparing. Her son Sanjay, whom she'd been openly preparing to succeed her in power, was killed in the crash of his private airplane. His widow, Monica Gandhi, left her mother-in-law's home to form her own political opposition movement. Mrs. Gandhi moved sternly against religious groups such as the Sikhs in the Punjab and Assam, who spoke about some kind of sovereignty from India. And in June of this year, of course, she ordered the Indian Army to assault armed Sikh militants who'd barricaded themselves and fired rifles from inside the Golden Temple at Amritsar. Hundreds of Sikhs and nearly 100 Indian soldiers, many of them also Sikhs, died in that assault. And untold scores, hundreds of other Indians later died in religious rioting around the nation. Mrs. Gandhi told an interviewer for the British Broadcasting Corporation,
"I'm not at all interested either in a claim or a place in history. I'm interested in serving the people, and I think I've given of my best."
Indira Gandhi, who was assassinated today in New Delhi at the age of 66. This is Scott Simon reporting.
The year before she was killed, Indira Gandhi was quoted as saying, "If I die a violent death, as some fear and a few are plotting, I know the violence will be in the thought and the action of the assassin, not in my dying." Writer Studs Terkel had a sincere desire to find out about history through the eyes of people on the sidelines. He talked with NPR's Susan Stamberg about his book, The Good War, An Oral History of World War II.
Sense of history, I guess, is the thing that drives me nuts, you know, the need on the lack of sense of history. What was it like to live at a certain moment, day to day? What was it like, and so working, what was it like to live during the Great American Depression or during World War II? And so I always call upon that Brecht poem. When the Chinese Wall was built, where did the Masons go for lunch? when Caesar conquered Gaul, was there not even a cook in the army? Or you might say, who built the pyramids? First reaction is, pharaohs. They didn't lift a finger.
Do you believe everybody has a story to tell?
That's a good one. I'm not an egalitarian that everybody's the same. They're not. Individuals are different. But I think there is a resource, a source not yet tapped in everyone, some more than others. There are stories to be told that are unexpected corners. I know it has to be reflective of the experiences of the many and yet uniquely that person's. That's one of the keys. I'll never forget this one guy. I got to tell you this. I'm doing working. He's a southern white guy. I call him Hobart Foot, something like that. Well, this guy is in his trailer, and he's a utility man at an auto plant. And he says, describe your day, Mr. Foot. And he's well, first thing I do, I open one eye, see, because the radio is going. I say, shoot. And then I go in the bathroom, I comb, I kiss my wife. That's routine. And I go in the bathroom, I comb my one hair. I got a few hairs, you know this hair, see. And then I come back, have a cup of coffee. But then, you know, it might be a half a cup of coffee. You can't tell. I have a piece of toast, sometimes two pieces of toast. I get in the car, I kiss my wife again. That's routine, you understand that. And then I drive. Now, he says, you know, I got those railroad crossings there, and you're docked for an hour if you're a minute late at the plant. And I got about six railroad crossings. Those freight trains go on, you know, sometimes 15 minutes. Some of it could be 17, 18, 19 minutes. Can't tell. But I think about those, and I come there, but I got a way of avoiding those tracks. I got a way of driving, you'll never know. And he described a story with such humor and suspense that his going to work that day, his getting up, was so dramatic. Contrast that with some musty academician who says, yes, my philosophy. Well, I get up and I teach philosophy one, and we have Spinoza. And he goes on. That's it. Someone may say something in an hour, bing. It's half an hour sometimes. I look for, well, you know, by this time, how does a conversation begin? All conversation is arbitrary. You know, someone asked me, well, do you change the sequence? Well, of course I change the sequence. It's as though a conversation itself is not something written in stone. I might begin saying, what's your first image when I say World War II? Or I might begin saying, well, the day you were drafted, there's any way you can begin it. Mm-hmm. There's no rule. I look for what the essence is of what that person's trying to say, to highlight not only just the truth, because truth itself can go on and on and on and on, the quintessential truth.
Mm-hmm. The advantage of books like yours is that these are the unpublished histories. These are the individual memories of those tiny little details and what it was exactly like in that factory when the detonators spread out all over the floor and the woman had to go creeping out in the dark.
Don't move anybody. They were afraid you'd step on the detonator. We were down on our hands and knees crawling out of that building in the storm. We were in slow motion. You know, if we'd stepped on one.
See, generally, I have a sort of hunch to begin with about a certain person. I read a little squib in the paper, or someone tells me about someone. I have a hunch. Now and then I misfire. I do a lot of time. But I mean, by this time I have a certain hunch that person's pretty good. It's what Morrow used to call the little picture, the small picture.
Studs Terkel won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, A Good War, in 1985. He died at the age of 96 on October 31st, 2008. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. There are people who go out of their way to smash up cars, and those who come to watch other people do it. Not surprisingly, movie director John Waters fits into both of those categories. He filed this report for NPR from the Dorsey Speedway near Baltimore, Maryland.
When I was a child, I was obsessed by car accidents. My parents used to buy me little toy cars, and I'd smash them with a hammer and say, oh, my God, there's been a terrible accident. So eventually my parents started taking me to junkyards, and I would be the little ghoul and stand around and look and think, imagine the horrible car accidents. Eventually, I've outgrown this. When I see a car accident today on the turnpike, I turn my head and won't look, because I feel if you look at it for more than 5 seconds, it'll happen to you. The cars itself, when they come in, they're coming in right now on the tow trucks, and I saw one that had written on it in huge letters, "We hate, we kill." And I think tonight is called Maniacs Night here tonight, which I can't wait to see exactly what. I'm not sure if they mean the drivers or the fans, but we will soon discover.
afternoon. It'll be four-wheel drives right here at Dorsey, charging through the mud bogs. That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock.
We're approaching now the pit at the Demolition Derby, which is a sight to behold. I would say there was about 100 cars here. I'm glad I'm with some other people. Some of these guys don't look too friendly on Maniac Night. Here we have approaching Crazy Tony and his family. If you win, how much can you win?
1,000 first place. You got to take all the heats.
But it's in reverse, right? The car is driving in reverse. Why is that?
Well, you get a head on, you're more chance to go through the windshield.
Mm-hmm. Do you wear seatbelt? I mean, is there any...
It's optional. It's in the car.
It's optional.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in this in the beginning?
In my driveway. I did the same thing in my driveway.
But who do you hit? What other car?
Friends' cars.
What do you do for a job in the daily?
We tow for Baltimore County.
Everyone is a tow truck driver. This is a convention of tow truck drivers, right?
Basically, yes. Body shops.
The drivers, what is one thing they have in common?
They're all crazy.
Have you ever won before?
Yeah, I was the feature winner of the spring season and last fall.
Was this your car originally ever your real car?
No, I look for them in yards with no tags and flat tires and just knock on the doors and say, what are you doing with the old car? And like to run it in
and
the Derby.
Fix and fix them up enough to run this one time.
Yeah.
So what do you have to wear when you go out there?
Some kind of fireproof clothing, but the fire equipment and stuff they have around here, there's very slim chance you're going to get caught in a fire and burn.
Yeah. But a helmet you have to wear.
Yeah, oh yeah, you have to have a helmet. The windshield has to stay in. The back window, they say, is optional.
What do you think, what model and what kind of car makes the very best car for a demolition derby?
Pontiacs are good. I like my Pontiacs.
Really?
They're hard to kill.
I'll find out what my baby like. I'll find out what my baby like. Got a whole lot of loving.
You get your yah-yahs at, you know what I mean?
Just like hitting crack on cars.
Oh, I love it.
What am I hooping?
Smashing up.
A lot of actions, a lot of blood.
Watch them tear them up.
Is this your idea of a good date?
I don't have a license.
So that's another thing I'm discovering. Many people here have had their license taken away.
I think it's nice.
My adrenaline boosts right up, boy, I'll tell you.
I think it's going to be fulfilling to everybody.
Your job is to what?
Crowd control.
Could that be a problem here?
Usually is.
You've got a beer hidden. Aren't you worried that guy's going to catch you that walks up and down?
Nah.
I hope nobody gets hurt, but, you know.
Would you like to drive in this race?
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be all right.
How would you improve demolition derbies? If they could do it, change the rules the way you wanted it.
No rules.
People like the destruction. I mean, everybody yells about all the crime and the murder and everything, the sex on TV, but people like that, and that's what they're going to come and see.
It is a field of dust, gas fumes. It is a conservationist nightmare. The moon is out, but it looks like the moon in Los Angeles with a lot of smog. When you leave here, your car is so filthy that you have to wipe all the windows. You can't even see when you leave. Your hair is filthy dirty. Your face is dirty. But I think that is why this is such a beautiful thing here. I mean, it is a subculture that a foreigner who came to America that saw this would truly not understand it, I think. I think that the reason this is successful is like the underside of the American dream of the love with a car, because this is destroying the car, which is what everybody wants to do in the first place.
Okay, all right, let's go. The flagman's got his green flag up, and we're ready. Here we go. 10, 9.
Movie director John Waters at the Dorsey Speedway in Maryland. Singer-songwriter Leon Redbone was making a name for himself in the 80s, performing on Saturday Night Live and The Johnny Carson Show. He cultivated a mysterious stage persona under a fedora, sunglasses, and a large, bushy mustache. NPR's Lynn Neary decided to do a little detective work.
Marie, the dawn is raised.
Watching him perform, I knew I had a mission, to uncover the real Leon Redbone, the man beneath this character he has created. When I met him backstage, I realized it wouldn't be easy. He was still in character. I decided to take a direct approach.
I'm curious about your props. The things that you bring on stage with you, what's behind the sort of character that you are on stage and the props that you bring with you on stage.
Just a little diversion. It helps to bring a little hilarity to the situation, depending on how things are going. Sometimes necessary to rely on something other than... it's just to break the I don't know what it's for. What's the idea of asking me that question anyway?
Well, I said to myself, that wasn't entirely successful. Maybe I needed to warm him up a bit more.
Do you have a good time up there doing that? Playing
I never have a good time.
You never have a good time?
No. But I try.
I went to church, my hat on, see the ladies and all, just to show that's free. Oh, did it, somebody tell me, give me that thing you're sitting on, my did it. Somebody tell me, did it.
Music. Maybe that would be the key that would unlock the mystery. Surely he'd be willing to discuss his own music. I gave it a try.
Some people, because you are a funny man...
Funny? Well, what do you mean by that?
Might think...
A very serious fellow.
I know, well... But you have a funny side to you. And they might think, perhaps, that because of that you don't take your music seriously. But the music that you play, I get the feeling that you really genuinely love that kind of music. Is that right?
I know it was a dumb question, but I had to get him going.
What else is there?
Did you grow up listening to that music?
I listened to nothing else but...
Why does that this kind of music endure? Why is it so appealing to so many people?
You can't beat a good melody. That's really all music is.
Melody.
Melody.
Something people can sing along with.
Mm-hmm.
The man was definitely getting the better of me, but still I wondered, what really makes this man tick?
So what's the idea of asking me that? I don't, who knows?
What?
By now I was getting just a little discouraged. But finally, I hit a nerve. I got him to admit the obvious.
One has to keep things under control.
Control's important to you.
I think control is the key word.
In your personality?
Yes.
Now I've got him, I thought.
So maybe that's why you also sort of control this...
Mm-hmm.
...personality that you present on stage.
It may have something to do with it, yes.
Okay, maybe it wasn't a brilliant insight, but he was beginning to wear me down, and he was still cool as a cucumber. I had to give it one last shot.
What's the question I could have asked you that's really the key to who you are?
Assuming I knew, I would be telling, wouldn't I? So I would probably keep it to myself.
Is there such a question?
Well, there just may be, but I'm not very good at questions. I'm beginning to question answers also.
Okay. That's it.
That's it. You give up. You give up yet?
All right. Good. You win. You win.
It was a great challenge.
I'm not sure who won on that one, but I do like the stream of conscious narration technique. Finally, to round out the month, we bring you the unfiltered Texas blues of guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan. He talked to NPR's Danny Zwerdling.
Until recently, Stevie Ray Vaughan was a little-known Texas guitarist who played in groups with names like Blackbird or Epileptic Marshmallow.
That was a mistake, believe me.
But then last year, Vaughan started getting some breaks. He backed up David Bowie on Bowie's Let's Dance album. Vaughan made his own record and won Guitar Magazine's Reader Poll for Best Guitar Album of the Year. Vaughan started moving out of honky-tonk bars and playing bigger halls, and now Stevie Ray Vaughan is being hailed as one of the hottest guitarists since Jimi Hendrix. When he and his band Double Trouble debuted at New York's Carnegie Hall recently, the New York Times said Vaughan's music turned the State Auditorium into a whistling, stomping roadhouse. Michael Jackson and Prince may still be getting more publicity, but Vaughan says his funky rhythm and blues is coming back to the mainstream.
The music's always been there, and it used to be top 40 music 20 years ago. You know, rhythm and blues was not a stepchild then. Mm-hmm. It was stepchild for a while here, and it's coming back.
Stevie Ray Vaughan says the music on his new hit album, Couldn't Stand the Weather, hasn't strayed much from the blues he's been playing for 15 years.
A lot of it has to do with the musicians that I've been around, that I got the chance to be listening to all this time.
Mm-hmm. Who were you listening to?
Well, of course, a lot of the blues greats, B.B. King, Albert King, Albert Collins, Freddie King, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters.
Who are some of the people we'll hear or we should listen for as we listen to your music?
Well, say Texas Flood, for example. It's got a lot of Albert King influence in it.
What's the sound you're trying to get at?
It's more of a feeling. It's a crying, but it's a soothing cry. Sometimes you get things out and they help you. It's a feeling. And Voodoo Child in the middle of it when it gets soft. That's Albert Collins' takeoff.
And then the screaming parts, Jimi Hendrix. I hear a lot of Jimi Hendrix in your
music. Well, everything I ever heard that excited me, I've got in my music on purpose. You know? Why leave it behind?
One thing I noticed listening to one of your albums is that you really seem to keep close to the basics. You don't have all sorts of fancy sound effects. Even the record sounds almost as if it's been recorded at a live performance.
It
doesn't sound like it's none of this fancy mixing in the studio.
When we record live in the studio, we just set up and play.
You have some really interesting music videos now. One of them has you and a woman who's supposed to be your wife, I take it, who is berating you because you're not spending enough time with her. You're in love with your guitar.
Right.
She threatens to leave you if you don't stop spending
so
much time
with
your guitar.
Yeah, she's going to move to Rio.
Right, and she looks into the closet to pack her clothes to leave, and it's filled up with your guitars. But I'm wondering, is this autobiographical at all?
Oh, it's not quite that bad.
Now, we just met your wife. I wish she hadn't left because I'd want to ask her, are you too much in love with your guitars as far as she's concerned?
Not too much, no. In fact, she's learning how to play now herself.
Maybe that's to compete with your lovers.
I'm married to her. My first wife's my guitar, but she understands that.
Give me back my wig. Wanna let your head.
those gals are so understanding. That's Stevie Ray Vaughan talking to NPR's Danny Zwerdling. And now for a short playback audio treat. I was listening to a piece about the Space Shuttle Challenger. When I came across this tidbit, it seems the astronauts were trying to hook up a conference call from outer space.
Challenger, we're now going to Jakarta, and hopefully you will be hearing from your colleagues in Jakarta.
This is Houston Press Center. Do you copy, Challenger?
Hang up and try it again. If you need help, hang up and then dial your operator.
Next month on Playback, our first file series continues with NPR's very own Noah Adams. He'll tell us about the first piece he ever worked on when he started at NPR in the 70s. Special thanks this month to the creative work of our Playback production team, Mr. Michael Katziff and Mr. Robert Speer. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback from NPR.